You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, January 30th, 2023. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jefferson Cowie, professor of history at Vanderbilt University, author of his latest, Freedom's Dominion, a saga of white resistance to federal power. Also on the program today, in the wake of the Tyre Nichols murder, Memphis disbands the police unit that killed him. Now, do the entire force. Also on the program today, debt ceiling negotiations frozen. McCarthy steps on a rake with his national sales tax. Meanwhile, Georgia declares a state of emergency in order to activate 1,000 National Guardsmen to control peaceful protests over Cop City. We'll have an interview on that tomorrow. New poll, majority see Biden cooperation with the document investigation and sees Trump obstructing. Meanwhile, majorities also anticipate that the Republicans are going to go overboard with hearings. You think?
Nah.
Meanwhile, Rona McDaniel wins the RNC chair election, robbing us of my Geo Pillow. I did my best. Utah passes legislation banning trans health care for youth. Now one of six states with similar restrictions. That makes 150 bills in 25 states to attack trans people in this country. And with 13 billion doses of COVID vaccine administered, 4 out of 5 60-year-olds and 90% of healthcare workers receiving at least one dose. The World Health Organization says COVID is nearing endemic status. 6,000 gallons of water used to extinguish a Tesla battery fire in California. Unclear how much the Twitter fire is going to take in terms of water.
Oh, God. It's Monday, baby.
DOJ asked the FEC to stand down in its investigation of George Santos. As their investigation goes forward, all this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Monday. I'm obviously just a little bit rusty on my headlines. It was so close. I feel like
another 15 minutes where it came up with something.
If I had another, another 10 minutes to the morning. But
hey, I'm not much better. So
I got a text that my neighbors put another hole in my wall. So after the last one just got repaired. So what are you going to do? It's Monday. Emma Viglin is here, of course, as she is every Monday, starting off the new week. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam.
There you go. Really off today. I don't know.
It's all right. Maybe we should. Just take
I'm super excited about this interview. Maybe that's it. And also just still incredibly disturbed about what we saw Friday. I guess it was Friday night when the Tyre Nichols video was released, and just absolutely brutal. And it has, for the moment, at least revived some of the energy that was in this country in 2020 in terms of some motivation to legislate and provide some oversight for police forces around this country. And recall that during the 2020 election, general election, Joe Biden was talking about increasing federal oversight of these police forces, because time and time again, we see this problem exists. The level of brutality, just the functioning of police in general. I mean, we've said this for years now. There's no reason for police to be doing any type of traffic stops whatsoever. No. There's just simply no reason.
Let alone a scorpion force, which is what has had to be disbanded. It's like a high crime task force, which, by the way, that was a very similar force as what killed Eric Garner here in New York. De Blasio did away with it, and then, of course, Eric Adams reinstated it.
Right. These things, there should be a wide slate of what the police do today that should be essentially pulled from their portfolio and given to other agencies and personnel who can do this. We have people who ticket cars when they're parking, the meter violation has superseded. There's no reason why we would need, officers with guns to go up to people and challenge them when their parking meter is overrun. And there's really no reason why we need to do that if you have a moving violation. We don't. But that's where we're at. I mean, that, among other things. But here is on, what was it, Chuck Todd's show, Meet the Press, interviewing Representative Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio. Imagine if this standard that he is propagating was to be applied to all of the things that are criminal in this country.
Yeah. What action would you like to see Congress do?
Well, I don't know that there's any law that can stop that evil that we saw that is just difficult to watch. What strikes me is just the lack of respect for human life. So I don't know that any law, any training, any reform is going to change. This man was handcuffed. They continued to beat him. And I was actually reminded, it's hard to watch the whole thing, but as I watched it, I was reminded of when we had a hearing probably 2 years ago when George Floyd's brother came and testified in front of the Judiciary Committee. And it was one of those moments where fact and truth and emotion all came together. And he said something at hearings, actually during the questioning portion of the hearing, he said, life is precious. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those moments that grabbed everyone in that hearing, both parties. And the fact that we saw that these five individuals did not have any respect for life. And again, I don't think these five guys represent the vast, vast majority of law enforcement. But I don't know if there's anything you can do to stop the kind of evil we saw in that video.
So,
I mean, imagine the idea that someone was talking about, just murder in general and go like, no respect for life. No,
abortion. We can't do anything about abortion then, right? If abortion is murder, it's just, sometimes people are going to do those kinds of things. There's no use for you in government then, Jim Jordan, if there's no way to legislate these kinds of things.
And understand, of course there is.
Yeah.
Of course there is.
Those cops are there because of a law.
Of course there is. I mean, A, we could just not allow the development of these type of forces, of these type of like squads. Mm-hmm. I mean, just as a like the most basic rudimentary starting point, the fact that they got rid of it is indicative of what you could do in every city around the country. You want federal funding? There is no squads like that. That's where you could start. And that, honestly, that is the most sort of like rudimentary, insufficient response to this. But everything he is doing is designed in the same way, like, he listened to George Floyd's brother, and the only thing he came around with is, like, you have to respect life. And that's what inspired us to do absolutely nothing in terms of police reform. That's what got us to actually, we all just simply agreed on that and felt like, job well done for us today.
Why do we have murder laws if all people need to do is just have a deep internalized respect for life? The reason we get people to respect others' lives and humanity is because we legislate and ensure and put guardrails in place to ensure that these the kinds of things don't happen. And I don't know if we have any energy on the Democratic Party side. I cannot unhear Biden chanting, fund the police, over and over again in his last State of the Union. I'm sure another one's coming up soon. What are we going to hear anything different? Because it's the funding goes towards these kinds of particular squads. That's the key here. And you may, as you say, Sam, reduce their funding and make a contingent on, okay, we're going to have a whole task force that's community-oriented, demilitarized. And the reason that this is even happening so quickly is because Memphis, for the first time in a long time, that county has a progressive DA, which I think, you know, we kind of missed on Friday in our coverage. They have a more of a reformer. And so some of this is going to happen at the local level, but it's not fast enough. Like, we have a Democratic president. It's time to lead, not just fundraise off of Black Lives Matter. Do something to ensure that Black lives do matter.
Yeah, I mean, I
just want to say his message is accept this as natural.
Right, exactly. And again, that federal funding, that is the mechanism in which you can legislate all sorts of things in terms of what the police can do, and also to support more prosecution of police. I mean, we know the difference between having consent decrees and having the DOJ essentially, you know, living in these police departments. And that should be step number one. And then we just need to basically make federal funding for police. They receive a ton of funding contingent upon beginning to sort of strip away certain responsibilities of police forces so that their interaction with the public is far more limited to areas where they're actually needed. But we'll obviously be talking more about this later in the program and in the days ahead. In a minute, we'll be talking to Jefferson Cowie, professor of history at Vanderbilt University, author of Freedom's Dominion, A Saga of White Resistance to Federal Power. I mean, not coincidentally. One of the first things that Trump did when he got in office, his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, rolled back all of the consent decrees and all of the involvement of the DOJ in local police forces that had been involved in all sorts of, gross racial disparities, which is not to imply that we don't see that across the board with policing. But those are ones that just ended up, on the Fed's radar, or at least enough so that they did something. But
Jeff
we'll talk more about
Jefferson
that.
Beauregard Sessions did that?
Yeah. Surprise, surprise. we'll talk more about that with Jefferson Cowie. Got a couple of sponsors today. One is from my favorite sponsor. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but SunsetLakeSebade.com. They have a major tincture sale going on. Remember, this company, majority worker-owned, $20 minimum wage for those who are hired more or less during the harvest. They grow all the hemp they use in their products. They do not use pesticides. It's all integrated pest management. They have practiced regenerative farming. Everything that they produce is third-party tested to ensure its quality and so that you know exactly what's in it, and also becomes a way of being aware of how much you want to take and your dosing and whatnot. All tinctures, and they have a wide array of tinctures, both in terms of like concentration and flavors, citrus, mint, original, 35% off until this Friday, February 3rd. 35% off. Sale ends February 3rd at midnight. All you do is use coupon code tincture at checkout. You will get 35% off all of their CBD tinctures. I use these to sleep. I use them when the kids are getting a little bit too crazy and I need to be mellow. Really fantastic. They have all sorts of other products, of course, and you can use Left is Best, their coupon code. You get 20% off of those things. But if you want a good night's rest, for me, the tinctures are the start of my evening ritual, if you will. You can save 35% off all tinctures at sunsetlakesebade.com. This sale ends on February 3rd. Also, apparently, several industries are going to be hiring this spring. e-commerce, healthcare, hospitality apparently is going to have more growth. Doesn't surprise me that much because everything sort of opening up post-COVID. Hospitality industry needs to hire for service positions, managerial positions, back office operations, all of it. But if you need to hire qualified candidates and you need to do so fast for any of these industries or frankly, anything that you're doing, ZipRecruiter. It is what brought us, I've used it in the past, got us Bradley, sort of like as a second order from getting Brendan. It is an incredibly easy interface to use, super effective. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter uses its technology. They find the most qualified candidates for a wide range of roles. Maybe you're doing a podcast video live stream. Well, ZipRecruiter can help you out. I assume there are other businesses that exist in the world, but I'm only aware of podcasting. They make it easy to send a promising candidate a personal invite, so they're more likely to apply. Also, their user interface in terms of organizing things, incredibly easy to use, very efficient. I am someone who gets really intimidated by that kind of stuff, and it was incredibly helpful. You can let ZipRecruiter keep your team growing strong no matter what industry. 4 out of 5 employers post on ZipRecruiter, get a quality candidate within the first day. Incidentally, I was one of those. See for yourself. Go to exclusive web address. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. And of course, we'll put a link to that in the podcast and YouTube description. Also, I cannot tell you how many conversations I've been having lately about honey. I thought that I had discovered Manicura honey, and I was the only person who knew about it. And I was talking to somebody over the weekend. I don't know why the honey came up, but
I didn't want to break it to you, but I'd heard it from a friend as well. So
seriously,
you were not striking gold quite yet. Yeah, I didn't want to break it to you.
Well, I was striking gold. I just wasn't the first to strike it, apparently.
Right. Right.
But this is the best tasting honey from New Zealand. I'm going to invest in big Manicura honey. It comes from the Manuka. Okay, so there is a tea tree called the Manuka tea tree in New Zealand. And apparently because the bees go and pollinate it, it makes, and I'm aware that, you know, what the bees are pollinated will impact the taste of the honey. But I have never tasted honey like this before. Like I say, it's called Manicura Kora. It is creamy and like caramelly. And apparently Manicura has, you know, been able to make sure that their beekeeping, their ethical beekeeping practices allow them to keep it 100% raw. It has unique antioxidants and prebiotics, has a natural antibacterial compound called MGO that only comes from the nectar of this tea tree. And they actually have different concentrations of this MGO. And you can see that on their website. Contains nutrients that support optimal immune and digestive health. I mean, for me personally, it has now become like sort of just a snack. In the evening, I'll just take like a spoonful of it. You can use it in your tea or your coffee. You can use it in your salad dressing or your ice cream, or I don't know. I mean, I put it on toast for the kids. It is really unlike any other honey you have ever tasted, certainly for me. And I've tasted a lot of different honeys. Buckwheat and wildflower and, just regular honey. And this is, I mean, just incredibly unique. Manicura Super Honey is available in a range of easy-to-use formats, including squeeze bottles and compostable honey stick packs, so you can eat it straight, add it to your favorite food or beverage. If you head to manicura.com /majority, you're going to automatically get a free pack of honey sticks with your order. That's a $15 value. That's manukora.com/majority to get a free pack of honey sticks with your order. It's called Honey with Superpowers for good reason. Get on it. Try this delicious, creamy caramel honey, and you won't look back with Manukora. And we will put that link in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. All right, quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Jefferson Cowie. He's a professor of history at Vanderbilt University, author of Freedom's Dominion, a saga of white resistance to federal power. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us, returning to the show, Jefferson Cowie, professor of history at Vanderbilt University, author of Freedom's Dominion, a saga of white resistance to federal power. Professor, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
I think we last spoke to you about the New Deal and the limits of American politics. And I wish we were doing the show, or at least I was adept enough doing the show back, I don't know, 10, 11 years, 12 years ago for the Staying Alive. But maybe we'll circle back on that. This is a really, like, sort of sadly relevant history. And it as a piece of history, it really sort of reminds me of other things that, you know, white rage. It reminds me that we have this, that history is not necessarily closed chapter, always, that this is sort of like an ongoing story. And you look at the use of the term freedom and its implications to the American story through the story of a specific county in Alabama. This is, the Barber County, Alabama. Let's just start with like, how both you decided that this was the locality to sort of establish the story. And then also how you came to understand the use of freedom, the concept of freedom, and the multiple ways in which what constitutes freedom. How you came to find that sort of concept?
Yeah, well, thanks. To reverse your order of your questions, I'll start with freedom and then go to why this place. And it ties into your previous segment, which was, you know, Jim Jordan saying there's no need for federal oversight on policing. This is all about the role of federal power in overseeing local political and means of violence, really, mechanisms, and how people on the local level make claims about freedom against those types of federal oversight. And so I began, you know, I'm a big cherisher of freedom, like many of us are, but I began to be concerned that my idea of freedom wasn't the same as everybody else's idea of freedom. I began to be afraid of things like the Freedom Caucus that is using this term in a way that is antithetical in a lot of ways to my idea of what freedom is. And so with that kind of curiosity in mind, I began to sort of look into the history of freedom and began to take it apart a little bit. And if we go all the way back to the roots of it, we see freedom rooted in ancient slave societies, that our very Western idea of freedom is connected to, not just not being a slave, but the capacity, the freedom to enslave, right? That you have the freedom to dominate, the freedom to oppress, the freedom to control. And, you know, that's only one part of freedom. And it's this sort of dark dimension of the complex of questions that we call freedom. But I began to be thinking about that, and that, you know, if freedom is the main dominant creed of American politics, of American life, American culture, what do we mean when we say this? So I began to think, well, how can I talk about why Americans have this anti-statist, anti-federal impulse, why they claim their freedom is opposed to federal power rather while they're simultaneously claiming to be patriotic, and how that works. So I began to think about, well, how might I do this? And I said, I need a place. I need one place. And we, and I could, by looking at a single place, I could explore the tensions in that place between local, state, and federal authority, what Madison called the compound republic, and that why these local people fought for freedom against federal intervention. And it just so happened I was driving to the Gulf Coast with my family, and we stumbled across Barber County and its main town, Eufaula, Alabama. And I began to think, this might be the place. My spider senses kind of went off, like, there's something interesting here. This is a fascinating place. And then when I got back to – I was teaching at Cornell at the time, and I got back to Cornell, and I began to do some research. And a couple months later, I found out, oh, George Wallace is from this county. Okay, this is fate. This is, you know, because all my other work sort of connected to Wallace in some way. So I was like, all right, this is it. That's how
In some ways, he couldn't be more of a – At
avatar
least in modern
for it?
Times.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. In modern times, I don't know if there's a greater avatar of someone resisting federal interference in the question of race in their state. But I want to go back to freedom just for a little bit, just for another moment, because some of this came from, I guess, Orlando Patterson's writing on some level of freedom.
That's right.
And he speaks of three different elements. Is it three different? I think it was elements of freedom.
Yeah,
will you just go through those things? Because I think, like, it's, I mean, it's obviously counterintuitive on some level to think that freedom means freedom to enslave. But it's also, that construction is really fascinating to me, because we hear that in the context of, like, tolerance and intolerance, almost like the inverse. Like, you guys say that you're so tolerant, yet you're intolerant of our intolerance. And
right.
and we see that it's almost like the inverse of that dynamic. But will you go through those concepts of freedom and explain sort of, like, and these are ones that are broadly in the Western, you know, I guess, psyche, if you will.
That's right. Yeah. So Orlando Patterson wrote two enormous books on the idea of freedom in the West, going all the way back to ancient societies. And his basic model, if we're going to distill, you know, 1,500 pages of dense prose, is
that's
that.
What we're here for.
That's right. That's why they pay me the big bucks. is to, he says that freedom is a chord, like a musical chord, and that it consists of three primary notes. And the first note is kind of the type of freedom that we all cherish, the Bill of Rights kind of freedom, the one that we have the freedom to dissent, the freedom of speech, the freedom that people cannot impinge upon our civil liberties, basically. Okay, so I think most Americans, more or less, kind of agree on that one. The second one is one we as Americans don't take as seriously, but we should, and that is the freedom to engage in a political community, the freedom to vote, the freedom to have the capacity to build a political community, to have a voice in that community, essentially civic rights. And then the third one is the problematic one, the dark note in the chord, the sort of sinister sounding part of this, and that is the freedom to dominate. He uses the word sovereignal freedom here. That is the sovereignty you have over a people, a land, a place. But it's really the freedom to dominate, the freedom to control. And apropos your earlier remark, you know, philosophically, my freedom ends right before I punch you in the nose, right? Like, I can't do that. But in reality, you know, that's really kind of the realm of the political philosopher. The reality is there's a long history of that idea of freedom not stopping with violence, with coercion, with control. And that begins really in Barbara County and much of the United States with the land grab from the indigenous peoples on which American freedom is really, really deeply based.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because what you do is you break down basically four periods. I mean, you know this, but four periods of Barbara County's history, starting with the dispensation of the Muskegee or Creek Nation. And it's we just spoke, I guess it was a couple of months ago, to Claudio Sant about the Unworthy Republic, which you know, talks about that dynamic of clearing the Indians, the Native Americans at that time, or the indigenous people, from the land, essentially to fill it full of slaves, essentially at that point.
That's right.
But walk us through the relationship, because there was a sort of like a, I guess, an ambivalent relationship between the federal government at that point. Part of it they were happy about, part of it not so much.
Yeah, ambivalence, an interesting word there. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Claudio Sant's book, The Unworthy Republic. Everybody should pick that one up. It's a marvelous history. My story is a little different than Claudio's in that we're looking at much the same area in the Southeast in the dispossession of Creek. He looks at Choctaw, Cherokee, a whole bunch of others, but I'm looking at specifically Creek land here. And the interesting thing is about looking at a community study, looking at one place, is you get a much richer, more nuanced, more sort of dramatic story because you're looking at a single place. And what happens in this one place is that Andrew Jackson, who is most famous as the man behind the Trail of Tears, the Indian Removal Act, the, you know, providing white people with land and liberty, actually tries to prevent white settlers from intruding on this nine county region on the western bank of the Chattahoochee River, which is the border between Alabama and Georgia. And he essentially sends in federal marshals and federal troops to kick white people out, to keep them from violating the terms of the treaty with the last remaining lands that the Creek people possessed at this time.
It's the Treaty of Caseta.
The Treaty of Caseta, exactly. And so it's almost impossible to wrap your head around this, because here you see the guy who's in charge of opening up all of Western lands, this was the West at the time, to white intruders. Well, in this case, he basically sends these troops in to kick white people out of Creek lands. And this goes against the whole narrative that we know, the whole narrative that Claudio Sant lays out in such clear terms. And what that does is basically ignites a war between the intruders and the federal government, the white intruders and the federal government. And so this area that I'm looking at ends up being born in a conflict with federal authority over whether white people have the freedom to take Indian lands. And in fact, the very first action that happens in 1832 is the federal marshals go in and set fire to the main buildings in the town of Eufaula to get them out of Creek lands. And so I'm not trying to say Andrew Jackson's any kind of hero. He's still a fairly villainous character, I think, in the history. But in this particular case, what we see is a sort of microcosm of what I'm talking about, which is white people want the land. They feel they have the freedom to take that land, and they make that claim in very specific terms about liberty and freedom. And the federal government comes in as a tyrannical act, tries to stop them from stealing land. And they fight back. This is the second American Revolution. We need to fight federal tyranny. That's no longer in our interest. And they turn against Jackson.
What was Jackson like? What was that Treaty of Caseta about? Was that essentially like we're going to clear the Indian Removal Act is going to get you out of, Georgia and here, but we'll give you, this is the frontier and you can have the frontier essentially. Or what was Jackson's motivation here?
Right.
For it. And then, and maybe also talk about like what feels like, I don't know if it's the first like Ruby Ridge type of situation with that guy Owens, but speak to that as well.
Right. Yeah. So again, that's why I'm not saying Jackson is some kind of hero, because his long game is to get everybody west of the Mississippi, get them out to Oklahoma, get them out of what is, as you put, some of the most valuable land in the world in the 1830s. Because
in terms of it just being very fertile.
Very fertile, black soil that makes cotton, makes white gold. Right. And so the plan was, they'd already taken over almost all of Tennessee, most of Georgia, most of Alabama, but they had left this strip of land about the size of New Jersey for the Creek people. And the idea was for 5 years, there would be no white intruders. The federal government would oversee everything, and they would come in and they would privatize all the land and give these large plots to each member of the tribal communities. It was a privatization scheme, basically. And they said, okay, you know, we are a practically defeated and devastated people. We'll take this deal because we will live to fight another day. We can preserve our traditions, and we have federal protection. And in contrast, though, the white intruders saw this as a firing gun for massive land grab, rather than an era of 5 years of federal protection. So Jackson's hope was eventually all the indigenous people would sell their land, take the money, and move west. But the deal was they would be protected. And the federal government tried, at least at first, to really protect their deal with the Creek people until things went bad. And one of the ways it went bad is this rascal, Hardeman Owens, you mentioned. He was he's kind of a nasty, unsavory character, one of the main intruders into Creek lands, and he's a grave robber and violent, terrible human being. When the federal marshals went to round him up, after a series of skirmishes, he goes into the federal marshals go into his cabin. The Indians warn him, be careful, it's rigged with dynamite. And he runs out just in time for the thing to explode. And the federal marshals pursue this guy, Hardeman Owens, across the landscape. And eventually, Hardeman Owens draws on federal troops, and a federal troop shoots him in the head before he's able to kill his commanding officer. And what this does, though, is creates a martyr. And again, this is the richness of local history. So now you have this martyr in which who has lost his life at the hands of federal tyranny. He's a freedom fighter who was killed by federal troops. And this spreads like wildfire, and the governor gets involved, and the Secretary of War gets involved, and Jackson gets involved, and everybody gets involved. And finally, Jackson sends out, of all people, Francis Scott Key, the author of The Star-Spangled Banner, to try and solve this crisis.
And before we get into sort of the next phase, which is sort of post-Reconstruction, I guess, what was the trajectory? I mean, did 5 years later the Creek peoples, most of the people who owned that land, sell it off? How successful was that treaty, I guess?
It was horrible.
And tell us.
Right. So this sets the pattern for the rest of the book, where the federal government comes in just enough to support minority rights, in this case, not even minority, oppressed people's rights, let's say, comes in just enough to rile up the dominant population, the white people, gets their blood boiling, gets their calls for freedom boiling, and they fight back. So they don't quite come in strong enough and powerful enough to solve the problem, but they come in enough just to kind of increase the demands for white freedom. And in this case, it's so sad. There's all these pleas by the Native Americans to Jackson and his Secretary of War, Cass, to please come in and help us. So you have the federal, you have the Indians asking for federal intervention as well. And much like we just, you know, we see today in policing, please come in and support us, because if we don't, if we fight back, if we, the Native Americans, fight back, we'll get slaughtered, right? Then we become the bloodthirsty, violent people we've been accused of being. Finally, it just gets too much. They can't hold back anymore. The federal government's too clay-footed to actually do what it's promised to do. And the Creek people begin to fight back. And once they do, then you have a huge war between, it's called the Second Creek War, and it's between the intruders and the Creeks. And then the federal government at that point has to come in, and they absolutely viciously crush the Creek uprising. And they're stripped of their land, and they're sent they have to basically march with almost nothing all the way to Oklahoma.
That is really reminiscent of what we see in this post-Reconstruction era. I mean, we do a lot of interviews on Reconstruction and that sort of like era as we enter into Jim Crow. And it's amazing how many coups, essentially,
that's right,
that took place in just about every state in the South. I mean, I don't know that off the top of my head, but it you know, I hadn't heard of the one in Alabama until this one. This is another moment where you use to show this dynamic with the feds. Tell us about this. This is we have, I guess, three former slaves who were elected to political office, and the white plantation class, of course, can't have this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, plus a guy named James Rapier, who was not enslaved, but he had been in exile in Canada, came down, and he was elected to Congress, the United States Congress, from Alabama, something that is yet to happen again from that district. Yeah, so the story of Reconstruction follows a similar pattern, but even almost more dramatic. Well, maybe not more dramatic. But the federal government goes down to basically with the goal after the Civil War to enforce the Civil and Voting Rights Act, the first two elements of freedom that we talked about earlier, in the South, right? And they're going to do it at bayonet point. Like, these people have rights, and there's nothing you can do about it. And this works pretty well. You have a functioning, flourishing, multiracial democracy, more or less. There's corruption, there's problems, but there's also problems in New York at the time too. So, you know, it doesn't serve us to get moralistic about this. But what happens is that finally the local whites have had their fill of federal power. They've had their fill of black rights. They've had their fill of black leaders. And they essentially, on voting day, November 1874, while freedmen are lined up to vote in downtown Eufaula, they, in an organized fashion, pull weapons out of every nook and cranny of the town and open fire on lined up black voters, shooting at least 80, probably more, voters. And this essentially, plus another coup in the northern part of the town, ended black voting rights in Barber County, Alabama in 1874. And so and this is another case where the federal troops are there, but they have orders to stand down. The black voters thought they had the support of federal troops at that moment, as they had for the previous several years and election cycles. But they had orders to stand down, slightly mysterious orders that I couldn't totally get to the bottom of. And they watched black people get shot in the street.
And this is, again, like the role, I guess it exemplifies the role that the feds could have played in this moment, but didn't, but still represented this force that is going to interfere in our freedom to take control back of our, you know, of our town, not their town, even though they're here and it's their town too.
That's right. And in fact, they are the majority of people in Barber County. Black people, it's a black majority county. Not only could they, but they did. I mean, that's how those people got elected in the first place, is because there was federal enforcement of voting laws and contract oversight and other things. So they went right up to the brink, and then they did not follow through at the last moment in that coup. And just a quick note on that. We often see this in memory as an election riot. And in fact, if you look at the little election markers down there, you'll see there was a riot here. Well, it wasn't a riot. It is exactly as you said. It was a coup. It was a massacre. It was a takeover of political power. It was a seizure of political power from people participating in the democratic process. The only possible way this could be enforced is either through local black armed resistance, which would end very, very poorly because they would be massacred, or very serious, unremitting federal oversight of voting rights during Reconstruction.
And then the third era that you talk about is almost like the beginning of the modern era on some level, in terms of the way that we had our chance in Reconstruction, and as a nation, it was really in many respects our real founding in many respects of this version of America.
Yeah, Eric Froder calls it the second founding.
Yeah, and this is the number that struck me was I don't have the exact dates I think here, but from that time in the Reconstruction era, that period, 8% of the prisoners in that county were black people. Within, I think, like 7 or 10 years, 91% of the convicts are black. And this is the full retreat of federal power. And we get a guy named J.W. Comer, who ends up having a lineage of pretty, that family it's not done. They were consistent, at least, I guess, is the best I could say. But walk us through what happens in that period.
Right. See, I call this third section federal power and repose. And I think retreat might be a better word, actually. But so as federal power moves out after Reconstruction, this is when the types of freedom that federal authorities have been fighting flourishes, this sort of white freedom to dominate. And the first thing that happens is after this coup in 1874, they start throwing people in jail. And it's not just it's not just because they think they're violating the law. It's because it becomes a system of political control and social control. And if you say anything against the Comers or any other elite family who might have been involved in that coup, you're off to the hooscow. But it's not just you're going to jail. J.W. Comer became a kingpin in Alabama's system of taking convicts out of these local jails and sticking them in the mines up in Birmingham in some of the most horrendous, miserable working conditions ever devised in the modern age. At least during slavery, people... slave owners had a vested interest in keeping their slaves alive. Not the case in the convict mines. There is no investment because you can just go get yourself another convict. And the local sheriffs have an incentive to increase the number of convicts because they can sell them into the mines. This keeps taxes down because you have a different source of revenue. it's kind of a horrifically perfect system for white people at that time. I want to just be clear, though, that there is no mining in this county. It's just the guy who runs the mining sort of convict operation is in Barbara.
He would rent out the he was basically the broker between prisoners and mines that needed. He was almost like the temp agency.
And he actually had his plantation running on these guys too, on these convict labor. So he basically had a neo-slavery system on his plantation after emancipation.
This was also coal too, right? And when we're talking coal
steel. And later, some of the biggest steel operations in the world, including U.S. Steel, bought in when they bought out the coal operations in Birmingham.
This gives you a sense of like what people had in mind, I guess, when they were pushing the 13th Amendment. I mean, it almost feels like you hear that story of what a business this becomes. It is, like you say, the perfect machine. It is social control, but it's almost all profit. And it almost feels like whoever wrote the 13th Amendment had this. this is our fallback position.
Right. Yeah. The 13th Amendment prohibiting slavery except in prisons. That's a longstanding language. And so it's hard to kind of pin a conspiracy on that language, but it was certainly a conspiracy to use that language very effectively for social control, political control, and economic revenue.
And then let's move into the fourth era. And, before we get there, let's get there. And this is essentially the rise of George Wallace and this quote. I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but this quote of his from 1964, which I'm going to paraphrase, was being a Southerner is not geographic; it's a philosophy and an attitude.
Right.
I mean, that is. I that sums it up. I mean, he got it right, and that was 60 years ago. And I mean, the durability of that quote is nuts.
Yeah, George Wallace is a little bit of a political genius, really. I mean, that's not to say I have any respect for his positions,
right?
But the guy knew how to build political power. My favorite quote about Wallace was somebody who said he could have parachuted into the Albanian countryside in the middle of the Cold War, and he would have been running the Comintern in three seasons. He just knew how to make things happen politically. And that vision that Wallace Country was the entire nation, he laid out in his 1963 inaugural address. It's a very famous address because he said segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. And this was the rallying cry for segregationists throughout the South to fight back against federal intervention and civil rights. But if you look at that speech more closely, he only uses segregation one at a time for a total of four invocations of segregation. He mentions freedom or liberty two dozen times. It's saturated with the idea of freedom that, tyranny is clanking upon the South and the chains are rattling and we need to fight and the federal bayonets are on the horizon. And so he knows that screaming about race is only going to get him so far. That's going to get him a lot of traction with the real racists. But screaming about the federal government is going to bring in the racists and it's going to bring in the tax cut types, the deregulation types, the anti-statist types for whatever reason. And now he's got a coalition. Who doesn't hate the federal government? Everybody's got a beef against the federal government. And so that really provides him traction. And that's how he really came to win the governor's office as the fighting judge of Barber County, because he fought the federal government after the 1958 Civil Rights Act when they wanted the voting roles for Barber County. He said he wouldn't give them to him. And so that's actually how he came to power, was fighting federal government.
That construction really, I mean, I see it a lot, I feel like, today, not just the freedom thing, like the, in the context of free speech, right? Like we see this, there is this sort of, sense on the right. And in addition to the idea that there's this, a philosophical, and sort of an attitudinal, we're of the South, but it's not, you know, it's not really, it's not a geographic thing. It is,
right.
It is simply a list of signifiers that we subscribe to. And, but that we see that now, like with free speech absolutism, it feels like on some level, which is sort of just a derivation of that freedom. Like it is, it, you know, we use segregation as an example, but it's really not just limited to segregation, even though that is really what we really want is this one dynamic. Yeah. To suppress others. But it's the same construction, it seems to me, with so-called free speech. The idea that, like, people are railing against the authoritarianism in, you know, people should use, you know, should use pronouns that people should want to use, or, you know, that the dynamic is similar, it seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not quite sure which angle you're going at.
Well, the use of that we don't hear that freedom is now sort of like that same dynamic exists, but it is in the form of like free speech absolutism, let's say, and the tyranny. The word tyranny is replaced with authoritarianism, the idea in that dynamic of, you need to be tolerant of our intolerance type of situation, is the sort of flavor of this same dynamic that we see today.
Well, again, I guess, you know, I personally, I don't care what anybody wants, you know, like, the lack of tolerance seems to be digging in on all sides, right? Right, left, center, everybody's, digging their ramparts and building the ramparts up deeper rather than just sort of, for me, I kind of don't care about that stuff nearly as much as I care about the right to vote and,
right.
The right to a fair wage and the right, you know, like core values. And I think all of this stuff, prevents us from talking about more fundamental questions. And that's, Wallace knew that too. He was actually originally kind of a progressive. He wanted to build roads. He wanted to build trade schools for people. So, and then he realized, nah, what people want to do is hate each other. And I can whip that up. And it doesn't matter what tool I pick up, whether it's, you know, what you want to be called or what, you know, what you, how you, he loved to make fun of how people dressed or whatever, make fun of hippies and things like this. He was very funny about it actually. And that all of that stuff pushes people, you can mobilize that, and he would fail continually on everything you try, but he always failed forward, because if you're fighting the federal government, you've got an infinite fight. You can always go to the barricades on that fight. And so, he sort of understood that, even his own political proclivities, which were tended to be more progressive Southern, would fail in the face of this sort of divisive kinds of hatred.
Well, let me ask you this, because you've made a great case about how this is uniquely American, how Southern ideology is, you know, it's not just being from the South. It's not just regional, as Wallace said. Is a way of life. It's a way. It's an ideology. But we're seeing some of this play out internationally, right? Like a lot of what you describe, reminds me of Israel-Palestine. In Brazil, we're seeing this kind of conception of freedom play out, even though in Brazil they have a different structure in the way that they conceive rights. Like we had an interview with Brian Muir, who talked about how in Brazil it's not a bill of rights, but it's meant to be a balancing act, the harmony of human rights. Mm-hmm. So you can't you can't have freedom if it takes away from somebody else's freedom, which we have less of a tradition of in the United States. And yet so many of these patterns that you describe are enduring and international. So what do you make of that?
No, well, so we can bring the conversation all the way back to the beginning when we were talking about Orlando Patterson. And he basically says this is a problem with freedom itself. The entire Western construct of freedom that gets exported around the world is actually connected to this problem, right? And so you guys have nailed it on the head that it's not just an American problem, even though, Wallace understood the power of it on the American stage, the entire country, not just the South. But so if we see the seeds of this idea of freedom being spread throughout the world, it takes hold in different forms. And what's particularly interesting about the American South is the United States in general, that makes it particularly compelling and unique is that it's a settler colonial society, right? People took over the land and lived there. And it's a chattel slavery society. And we don't very often see both of those. Brazil is another case where we see a similar dynamic. But the degree to which the United States has both of those makes it, I think, a particularly powerful representation of this. So powerful that it also gets doubled down and exported, right? So, what we've seen in Brazil lately is a kind of a replica of what happened in the United States on January 6th. And in Israel, I think, much the same. So I guess I'm trying to make the case that, A, it's a problem with freedom itself. And that's why I'm not just saying it's the rhetoric of freedom. I'm saying it's freedom.
Is it freedom within colonial countries, right? Countries
especially,
built
right.
on colonized. I mean, because you can see that there's with those examples that we're just describing, that is a clear delineation from other countries, maybe of similar background.
Right. So there might be a tradition of freedom, say, as in England or France. France, it's obviously connected with some fraternité and égalité too. That was going to be exactly where I was going, is that when you see it let loose in this colonial sphere and you see it with the land grab plus possession of other human beings and your freedom to do both of those things, it really kind of almost metastasizes this Western idea that we're struggling with here in the American context.
I want to talk about some of the pushback that we saw from activists, within the context of Barber County. But I just want to return to sort of what I was talking about, that dynamic, because it seems to me, if Wallace was right, that this is not no longer about a geographic, and all of the material implications of what comes along with a geographic identification, right? And also the temporal issues that are associated with that. We're not dispossessing members of Creek Nation at the moment, and we don't have chattel slavery, but it's become a philosophy and an attitude. It seems to me at different times, right? And I think in your book, you're highlighting times where there's sort of specific types of material implications to this philosophy. But as that philosophy gets nationalized and it can't be applied in the same way, is not like, and I bring up trans stuff only because, we have 150 bills in 25 states right now that are directly implicated in trans care. And if I had to bet, without looking at those 25 states, there is no doubt in my mind that every state that had the highest number of slaves in a list are included in those states, in those 25 states. And and that this sort of round of what we're seeing in terms of transphobia was, in many ways, has its roots to a letter from the Obama administration, to schools saying, don't forget, This is, you know, I think it was Title IX. This is the way that bathrooms are, you know, people can go to the bathrooms that they're identified with in schools. And 9 years later, 10 years later, it has got to the point where there is massive legislation. And that's the dynamic that seems to me to be like the same dynamic. It's just that we're going to apply it in different areas. It may be the IRS one day, but it's always nice to have a marginalized community that we can all agree their rights don't.
That's right.
I mean, because what's the infringement associated with trans people? It really, there's nothing.
There's not that much.
but it is this notion of like, of that dynamic, which seems to me to be going on there.
Yeah. And it, when you bring together a sort of traditionalism of any form that's fighting against federal authority, you've got a dynamic relationship. And that's what you're seeing. That, you know, you just described that perfectly, you know, whether, you know, these kind of crazy fights that we're seeing all over on these questions. And it's, my book is in essence an argument against states' rights and in favor of vigorous federal enforcement of important social and political questions. Now, what other people say is, well, wait, what about local traditions? What about our way of life? What about we know best? We're the laboratories of democracy. Well, that's not really how history plays out. That all tends to be euphemistic for social control over embattled peoples. And federal government is the only real leverage that a lot of those folks have. Let me give you an example. And the scales fell from my eyes on this project when I was studying the civil rights era in Barber County. And I got a couple chapters on what happened with the Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference movement there in Barber County in the mid-60s. And Hosea Williams, who's Martin Luther King's kind of key lieutenant, he's the guy who gets stuff done for SCLC. And he's poring over all the county registration numbers after the Voting Rights Act. Like the federal government has come in and said, you have the right to vote. Here it is in federal law. And so they fan out. They try to register as many people as they can. And there's a strong movement in Barber County. And Hosea Williams is back in Atlanta, and he's trying to figure out all the numbers. He's like, why do places that have a good movement have lower registration numbers and places that have not that good a movement have high registration numbers? And it's a mystery. And then he finally realizes that all the places with high voter registration numbers are places with federal registrars. And that the federal government matters. Social movements matter, sure. Leadership matters. The laws matter. What mattered was federal boots on the ground to make sure that the laws were followed and enforced as written. And that, you know, that's the untold story of the civil rights movement. They didn't try to cross this bridge at Selma just to cross a bridge at Selma. They crossed the bridge at Selma to get the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, in Little Rock, it wasn't just a bunch of kids trying to get into school. It was, but it took the 101st Airborne Division to make it happen. It takes vigorous federal enforcement for these things to work.
What, and I guess I'm just curious, and this may be sort of outside of your purview as a historian, but what of an era where the federal government is receding? Like, you know, I talked about Jeff Sessions pulling off those consent decrees from police departments. Right. We've seen a Supreme Court that gutted has effectively, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it gutted at least, I don't know, three quarters. We can argue over like what part of it, of the Voting Rights Act. What do we do in an era like that? How is that addressed when you don't want to necessarily subscribe to a philosophy of like states control?
Right. Exactly. No, that's it. What do you do? You need to mobilize politically for more federal power. I mean, both there's a wing of the left and a wing of the right that hate the federal government, right? And I'm very my argument is with both of them. Many of my fellow progressives are very suspicious of federal power. They see it as imperialist and racist and all that stuff. And that may be very well may be the case, but it's also the only tool there is. And so if you look at the book, the third section is all about when the federal government's not there. And what happens? Convict leasing, a rise in lynching, Jim Crow constitutions, disenfranchisement, all these horrible things. I have a chapter called Lynching is an Act of Freedom. It's a horrific concept, but there it is. And that's why the federal authority is the number one issue when conservatives come to power. They want to either use it for their own purposes or strip it of anything that might interfere in local ways, local traditions.
I don't want to get too sidetracked, but it's hard for me to accept that the left's suspicion of the federal government is as fundamental to its leftness. I mean, we can find anybody, anywhere, right? I mean, we can find anybody on both sides who has, but it seems to me that conservatism, being essentially a neo-Confederate, and maybe this was different, prior to, I don't really think it was, frankly, prior to the Civil War, but being a neo-Confederate as opposed to really, a libertarian, if you will, that is fundamental to conservatism. Like, if you strip that notion of federalism away, there's really not a lot that's left anymore. I mean, we can argue that I really don't. I mean, I could come up with it, what the alternative argument is, but a lot of those roads lead back to we don't want federal control.
That's right.
And that to me seems the fundamental difference. You can find skepticism of maybe our foreign policy and maybe parts of the national security state, but it seems to me ineffectiveness in addressing certain problems. But in terms of like the concept of a federal government, one is like, for instance, like we can see left and right criticize media, but one wants to have, I think, a more vigorous sort of mainstream media, and one wants to sort of like defeat it and have it, weaponized in a certain way. I think there's a similar dynamic going on with federal, with the idea of federal government.
No, I completely concur. I think you might underestimate how suspicious the left is of federal authority. You know, it's the people who brought you Vietnam and Watergate and corruption and racism and stuff like that. But I think people on the left really need to regard this as a serious, possibly the main tool in affecting civil rights, voting rights, everything else. And the recent blows you mentioned, the blows to the Voting Rights Act, which are horrendous, right? I mean, until voting rights are ensured, gerrymandering's done away with, and I'm not even getting to financing of elections, just running a fair election, right? The federal government is the only place you can go. And that's the only insurer of democracy. I think there's a fantasy among many on the left that democracy is a local thing. We all gonna like fight the man together, but the key arsenal is in Washington.
Fair enough. And I should say, like there's a lot of mention of the pushback, particularly in that era of George Wallace that's coming out of Alabama. Fred Gray gets a mention in there. I was fortunate enough years ago to interview him. In a tort law conference of all places, in Las Vegas, but
he is a hero of this book. He just, just did the work, showed up in court, endless cases in federal court in Southeast Alabama from Montgomery on down. Just amazing. What a hero that guy is.
And we should also say there's also a big tradition in Alabama in particular of like radical politics of communists at that time who, were also like heavily involved in financing a lot of the cases that took place in the 20s, at least a couple, if I remember correctly.
Especially up and around Birmingham in the coal mining regions, and then some in the Tenant Farm Workers Union, Southern Tenant Farm Workers Union. There's a great book called All God's Dangers. It's a long interview biography of a sharecropper who's involved in the Southern Tenant Farm Workers Union shootout with police and all sorts of crazy stuff. Highly recommend that book from the 70s. And, of course, Robin Kelly's book, Hammer and Hoe, on the left in and around Birmingham.
Yeah, we had him on. I can't remember when it was. Maybe it was back in 2014 or 2015. Interviewed about that, but also fascinating.
Yeah, my county is sort of the anti Robin Kelly area. It's not. It has. It's out in the periphery. It's kind of the middle of nowhere. It's where, on the one hand, not a lot happened, but on the other hand, it's the things that did happen there is the way it happened in the vast majority of places in the world. I mean, we focus on the Memphis's and the Montgomery's and Selma and, you know, Atlanta. But really where a lot of this happened is unknown territory. And that's why I wanted to choose a fairly obscure place.
It's a fascinating piece of history. Jefferson Cowie, professor at Vanderbilt University. The book is Freedom's Dominion, A Saga of White Resistance to Federal Power. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm and in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, it was a real honor and a great pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks. We are going to head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your support that allows this show to survive and thrive. And also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Emma, ESPN, you can spend any time on the absolute non-foul that took place in the Celtics game over the weekend. Completely unbelievable how it's been manufactured out of thin
great defense air. by the Celtics
great
there.
Defense. Tatum was like one little brush on the arm, and all of a sudden, like, we couldn't even play the rest of the game.
Call the wambulance.
I've never seen LeBron so upset.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, that was incredible. But we will primarily, we'll touch on some NBA stuff as well, but we'll primarily be talking about the conference championship games. Has the NFL reached a breaking point in terms of refereeing? It's the worst it's been probably since I've started watching, as well as what the hell is Jerry Jones doing with the Dallas Cowboys, Kellen Moore going to the Los Angeles Chargers? What does that mean for that team? YouTube.com/ESPN show at 4 p.m. today.
Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leck Media enterprise?
Yeah, yesterday for Left Reckoning.
Say Matt Leck Media, because I say the.
Yeah, you gotta lose the definite article. You would have been saying the Arcade Fire.
Drop the
is it not the Arcade Fire?
No, just Arcade Fire. Yesterday at Left Reckoning, patreon.com/leftreading was part two of David Griscom and I's reading of Rosa Luxemburg's Reform or Revolution, a really interesting text that bears a lot of relevance on both our discussion of labor politics and parliamentary efforts. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning. I think Rosa Luxemburg really gets it. She really gets it, as they say. So check that out.
She certainly got it.
She certainly got it.
All right, folks, number 646-257-3920 is the number. We will take your phone calls. We will take your IMs. We've got a lot to talk about in the fun half, and we will see you there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back. back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay, I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back. Back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on.
What?
Come on.
What?
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.